Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her fifth novel, At the Water's Edge, Sarah Gruen has created another very intriguing setting and cast of characters reminiscent of her number one New York Times bestseller, Water for Elephants. The opening snapshot of At the Water's Edge include a young socialite in Philadelphia, a social misstep on New Year's Eve 1942 that changes everything, a journey by ship from America to Scotland during World War II, a husband, a best friend, and the tiny highland village of Drumna Drocket. Sarah Gruen is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of Water for Elephants, Ape House, Riding Lessons, and Flying Changes. It's a great pleasure to welcome her to this week's book show. Sarah Gruen, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
What brought you to this particular time and place?
It was completely circumstantial. I was procrastinating in my office one day, as I am wont to do, and I came across a online article about, actually it was about declassified documents and government secrecy, but one of the classified documents that had just been made public was a 1938 letter written by a high-level official at Scotland Yard, and it talked about Nessie, and there was absolutely no doubt in this person's mind, and obviously in the people that he was corresponding with, that the beast existed. And also he was lamenting that he did not think that the police had the power to protect it against the big game hunters that were gathering at the time. Mm. And so I fell down a Nessie hole that afternoon, and I'd been to the Highlands when I was 12 for the first time, and really fell in love with particularly Urquhart Castle. And of course I wanted to see Nessie and thought I would. And so I just thought it was a really, really rich setting and had all sorts of possibilities.
Nessie, of course, also known as the Loch Ness Monster. So once you think of that, then how does this fill in and become so intriguing and have all these wonderful characters that are attached to this place and time?
It's a really organic process, and it's not something that I consciously control, or I would, but I actually just have to depend on it continuing to happen. So when I decided that that was the setting, I still didn't know the timing, and I didn't have any idea of story. So I booked my first research trip right away. And when I was in Scotland and in the Highlands and traveling around, I found out more about the level of involvement in World War II. And I don't think of Scotland as being very involved in World War II, but in fact, that's where the commandos, the modern-day commandos as we know them, were formed in World War II in Scotland, in the Highlands, at Achnacarry Castle, which became Castle Commando, which was where they trained. And the D-Day landings were practiced on the North Shores, and occasionally the Nazis would mix it up by flying bombers down the Glen from Norway as opposed to across the Channel from France. And so there was really, really a high-level involvement. And so I thought that was definitely having a war in the background. It adds a level of instability and sort of imminent danger that is good for ratcheting up tension. And the characters, the story itself, didn't come to me until I was there. I'd been there 2 weeks, and I was walking around Urquhart Castle, and I was the only one there, except for my guide, which is really unusual because there are usually piles of tourists there. But I was at the Watergate, and all of the things that I'd been learning and taking notes about, just sort of randomly taking notes about, started to form a story as I was at this place where Nordic and Viking storms had taken place, and really standing on those very stones. It was just kind of a magic moment. And so I sent my guide back to his car, and I spent the rest of the afternoon by myself in Urquhart Castle dictating my ideas for the story were into my cell phone.
When it comes to those research trips, let us begin there, because I remember talking to you years ago when Water for Elephants first came out, and you told a story, I always remember this, of telling a story about going in to a museum and the circus wagons were there. And I think one of the guards yelled at you because you were like on your back underneath looking at the wheels of the circus wagons.
And looking in the trunks underneath and going around corners and snooping.
General mischief at the circus museum.
So, I think they don't have a lot of people coming there and spending all day there either.
So perhaps they're a little suspicious. So when you go on a research trip like this, do you know what you're looking for? Do you know what kind of mischief you want to get into as to the, in this particular case, in this story, of what you wanted to give us that nuance?
I did not. I go there, and of course, I didn't know what anything except for the setting at the time that I got there. But once it started to come to me, I had a few adventures. I was handed a round of live armor-piercing ammo from World War II, which is really unstable at one point. And I was trying to play it cool, and I was holding this thing, and I was like, oh, there's numbers. I don't know. I didn't know what to say. I was just holding this armor-piercing ammo. So I said, oh, there's numbers. I wonder what those mean. And the guy took them back from me, and he pulls out a flint, and he starts like trying to shine up the numbers on this live ammo with a flint. And I was like, no, no, no. And, so that was one. And then there was the day that I was a little car chase, a little bit on the wrong side of the law, but I had been looking for World War II ruins, and they're everywhere. They're just, they're repurposed as farm buildings at this point, but they're very recognizable. They're all red brick, and they all have the same color trim. The windows and door frames are all this kind of almost robin's egg blue. And so we came across this installation, and it was huge, and it went on and on and on, and eventually there was an air tower. And so we stopped, and the gate was open, so we went in, and I went out, and I mean, they're just enormous buildings, and I went through a barracks, and I think it was a garage for a barrage balloon. I really don't know, but I went through a bunch of buildings, and it was really haunting, because especially in the barracks, I was there with, I don't know, a handful of sheep, and I was picturing it being full of young men. And of course, this is where the D-Day landings were practiced. And so I wondered how many of them came back, and so I headed toward the air tower, and my guide popped his head out the window, and he said, I don't have a good feeling about this. And so I said, all right, and I got back in the car just as the RAF pulled in another gate, and we were, uh-oh. So off we went, and we went through back roads and farm roads and winding little roads, and we got away, and we found all sorts of other installations, but they were repurposed again as farm buildings. But when we got back to the hotel that night, and we got out the ordnance map, that whole area was marked with bold red skull and crossbones, and I had been walking around on current and World War II live bombs, because that is an RAF field where they still drop bombs.
So, wow.
In my opinion, they should lock the gate. That may just be me, but...
Seems to be a good conclusion, actually.
Yeah.
Just maybe lock the gate. So as you're doing that, Do you start to fill in the blanks and think of, okay, this is how I can maybe use that? Where does that come along?
Yeah, absolutely. And there was one other time I tried to convince the equivalent of the Coast Guard of Loch Ness to throw me in with a rope tied around my waist, because I don't want to give anything away, but I wanted to experience it so I could describe it. And they refused, but I was, and I actually did get lost in the cover, which is it's a woods that, Drumna Drachet is right on the shore of the loch, but you can't see it from the village, because it's so, there's this cover that's called the cover, and it's a woods. So I went walking in there, and who wanders into the woods by themselves without telling anyone that they're there and not having a cell phone or a compass or anything? Well, that would be me. And I went in circles, and I was just desperate. And, I finally came across some fishermen, and I was just like, I need to, please help me. But anyway, they got me out. But I incorporated things. I'm always looking, if I have an experience that's sort of out of the ordinary, I'm always, why have them if you can't use them in your fiction?
Sarah Gruen is our guest on this week's book show, the new novel, At the Water's Edge. Let me talk to you about the cover of this book, and it has a picture of of a lovely woman on the front of the book. And then on the bottom there is a bit of an X-ray or a sketch of what we assume then is the Loch Ness Monster. Is that fair to say?
I think it's very fair to say. I really love the color, the cover. It was not anything like I was expecting it would be, but I'm not a designer. And so I can gush about it because I didn't have anything to do with it. But the cover, it's almost like a holograph. Or a hologram, whichever. Because you can hold it in different lights and angles, and there are sometimes you can see only the embossing of the monster, and other times you look at it and the monster just looks like a piece of veil over her face. And I also think that the little bit at the bottom, which is the tail, the open mouth at the top, I love as well. But the tail at the bottom, it feels like a nod to Rosie because it looks like an elephant trunk.
The reason I ask about it, and realizing it's radio and it's hard for people to perhaps imagine, but if you were far away in a bookstore and you were looking at this, you would basically just see the face. And it would give you a completely different idea of this novel until you get close.
Right, until you see that the veil is actually a monster.
That's right. So talk to us a little bit about why that works because of your heroine, Maddie Hyde.
Well, the monster image and the metaphor, of course, goes all the way through the novel. There's the obvious one that is Hitler. But I think that most importantly for me, the monster looming in the loch is representative of the internal monsters that we can find in ourselves or sometimes in people close to us. And what do you do when you find that and you're faced with the truth? Do you turn and look at it and bravely decide where to go next? Or do you turn and run? Or do you try to glue the facade back together in Humpty Dumpty style? And I think that those are the things that define us as human beings.
Talk a little bit about Maddie Hyde and how you came to this character and what you wanted her to be.
Well, at the beginning of the book, during the writing process, which for me is extremely organic and very, very messy, and it's different from book to book, so I really don't have a process per se. but it took me about half the book to figure out that she was the heart of the book, and then I had to go back and change it to first person. And it was only about, it was during my third run at it that I knew who all the characters were, and so I went and started again. And I wanted her to seem like she was a bird of a feather with Hank and Ellis at the beginning, because she goes along with their capers and their adventures and their pranks. But then you realize that she's being what they need her to be, because that's all she's ever known. She grew up in a home with a mother who was very much like that and a father who is indifferent at best. And she's got a very dark past. She's in some ways been very sheltered from the outside world, but she's also gone through she's never been hungry and she's never been homeless, but she's been really just, it's been sort of an emotional void, and she's never had anyone. And she's, of course, married to this guy, and she has no money. She doesn't have anyone. She can't get away. So when they decide that it's a good idea to go to cross the Atlantic during the Battle of the Atlantic, she has no choice because she's got nowhere else to go and she's got no money.
Class is very much a part of this story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The artificial barriers that people create was, and this is a longer story than I think I can go into, but the article that first interested me in going this direction was very, there was a real divide between Scotland and England that was growing again, the Scottish nationalist movement. And so it was only when World War II came along that this thing that was really a political powder keg, and it was all about the Loch Ness Monster, when it came to it was going to come to a head, but then World War II came along and they dropped their differences and joined together to fight a larger enemy. And so I was very interested by the way that these artificial barriers that people create shift according to convenience or whatever. They're not real. And in the case of Maddie, she's grown up with servants and household servants, basically. And so but it's not something that she chose to espouse. It's just something that was always there. And when she gets to Scotland and is ripped away from everything she's ever known, she begins to see, well, the people there, the people who work at the inn, are the first people in her life who've ever judged her by her own merits and not by what she can do for them. And she's so, I mean, she's just delighted at having friends. She's been so emotionally hungry her whole life. And so for her, these barriers just absolutely dissolve instantly. And of course, it's a different story for Ellis and Hank, because one of the truths that Ellis should face and doesn't necessarily is that he's mediocre at best. He's built himself up in his own mind to be something really spectacular. He's really too important to risk his life going to war, and his mother has fed this because he's the apple of her eye. But his internal truth is that he's mediocre. So he hangs on to the class barriers and the class distinctions and gets more and more obsessed with finding the Loch Ness Monster, which to him is his salvation. It's his only way out of this pickle he's gotten himself into, and his only way back into the good graces of his father and, more importantly, his father's pocketbook.
This idea of her kinship with these women that she meets in Scotland, of Anna and Meg, is fascinating, because as you write in the book, that there's a realization that her life before was nothing but a pretty, pretty fraud.
Yes, and they become friends to her before she's even aware of it. They're doing things for her on a friend level when she's not quite figured that out. Of course, when she does, she's delighted, because although she's always wanted love, she's actually just thought that that was sort of made up, and she was not really missing out on anything because it was all just hype. But the one thing she's been aware of is wishing that she had friends, and she didn't have that as a child because she was isolated, and then the various family skeletons followed her to boarding school where she was a pariah, and then she fell into the loving arms of Ellis and Hank. And so when she realizes that they're actually friends, it's just sort of it's a watershed of joy for her.
And there is the love triangle, right? You wanted that.
Yeah, there's a couple of love triangles.
Yeah.
You have some intersections, yes.
And you wanted that. You like to explore that.
Well, I think, I do. It's something that happens a lot. It's innate to our nature. It's like the divisions thing, but it also is counter to most cultures and social mores. So it pops up everywhere. So it's in fiction of all kinds, going back to as early as recorded. And I like to explore why it happens and what society perceives it as, and is it ever okay? Is it ever forgivable? Or does society feel the need to always punish someone? Or is it allowable to have made a mistake and the other person is out there and that's the person that you should be with? And, you know, there's just so much kind of fertile ground to explore in that. And it's not just internal to the characters who are involved in the triangle, but also the perceptions of the people around them and how they're treated.
When you start to go into this and discover these characters, do you have an idea initially of who the bad guy is going to be?
I have ideas, all kinds of ideas at the beginning, and then my characters come to life and they throw all my ideas out the window and set fire to them and stomp all over them. And I've learned, at this point, I know that that's supposed to happen and that's when things are going right. And so I actually embrace it, because it's when they come to life and they throw out all my plans for them that I get into the sort of state where I feel like I'm recording instead of creating, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Like I'm living inside a movie and I'm not in control. And that is really, I think that an organic, for me, I can't outline. I think that the storyline will find itself. And if you have the characters and the right kind of chemistry, then it will happen.
When it comes to the actual conclusion and what it is that you want to say, you get there through how many drafts and through how much thinking?
A whole lot of thinking, and I'm just going to say this part quickly before I go back to the drafts thing. But when I'm at the end, it's a very obsessive process, because I really, that world for me is alive and it is real. And right now, even though I haven't been writing it for a while, I can still, I know exactly where every cobweb is and which floorboards squeak in that inn. And so at the end, when I'm trying desperately, because I edit things till they're ripped from my hands. I mean, literally, it's sort of they walk in and say, walk out with it under their arm and they say, you're done. So, but at the very end, I can't sleep. And I was turned into a vampire. I was up till 6 every morning. One day I ran into my son in the kitchen and I didn't know it was 7, but I said, what are you doing up so late? He said, Mom, I'm getting breakfast. I'm going to school. Go to bed. I was like, ooh. But, you know, I will stay, I will be asleep, but my brain will be editing something for however long it is I'm in bed that I've never written. So I wake up and I realize I've been trying to fix a plot point that doesn't exist. So, you know, that's how crazy I get at the end of it. But for the drafts, you know, it's, I think I mentioned that it takes me a while to find the characters and I have to throw out what I've written several times to start. And it's in fits and starts. So I start at the beginning each time I have to do it. And then there's, of course, bits I can keep and bits I have to adjust. And then I go back and forth because it's sort of layering. And if you think of it as a tartan, then I have to I have to go back and make sure that all the threads I'm trying to carry at the same time are pulled up at the appropriate pace. And so I'll have to go back and pull one of them through very carefully. And I sort of, in fits and starts, find my way to the end of the first draft.
Sarah Gruen's new novel is At the Water's Edge. It is published by Spiegel and Graw. As you just described a moment ago of having that the pages torn from your hands, and then it's on a life of its own. Obviously, you could have never anticipated the life that Water for Elephants would have taken on. 43 countries, 10 million copies of the book, made into a film in 2011, and now, if what we read is correct, a stage musical is in the works.
Yes, it is.
So, but before I ask you the obvious question of how they're going to get an elephant on stage, I ask you the other question, which is, what is it like to, at what point do you realize that this, okay, this is great, but it's really out of my control?
It really took me a long time. With Water for Elephants, nobody knew what I was doing because Riding Lessons, my first book, was a moderate success. And by moderate success, I mean that nobody cared what I was doing for the next year. And what I was doing was writing Water for Elephants. And I now know, just because of all the rejections it got, that it was, people would have told me not to write it if I'd said anything. So I'm really glad I didn't, because it's kind of a genre-defying piece and nobody quite knew what it was. And, you know, my editor at the time rejected it and asked me in the same email to please write a sequel to Riding Lessons. And so I turned around and wrote Flying Changes after I'd written Water for Elephants while we tried to shop Water for Elephants. And it went finally, it went to Algonquin, but, you know, it was, and my editor at the time thought, you know, it was a beautiful book, but it was going to be a small book. And then the marketing director took it home and he read it and he came back and he threw it on Chuck's desk the next day. And he said, this is the next big seller. We can sell this to everybody. The elderly, my mother-in-law, my wife, my brother, you know, it's because it was genre defying. And if you stopped trying to put it into one, then it became clear that you could market it to a larger group. And this all happened before I had no idea. I mean, I wrote part of it in a walk-in closet. So I was, you know, I stumbled forward into the daylight with a book and I had no idea if it was any good. And it almost didn't sell. And it was supposed to be a small print run. And then all of a sudden I was going on a 35-city tour. But it was a very slow burn. It was a grassroots thing from the independent booksellers and from the librarians and from people who just felt passionate about the book and who refused to let it just slide downstream unnoticed, for which I'm all going to be grateful forever.
So are they casting elephants right now?
No, I'm very, very lucky that it was Peter Schneider who took an interest in it. So, and he's the producer of The Lion King. So I'm expecting some absolutely fabulous puppetry.
Very cool. The new novel, At the Water's Edge, is published by Spiegel and Graw. Sarah Gruen, it's a great pleasure, as always, to speak with you. I wish all the luck in the world, and I thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you so much, Joe. I hope it won't be 4 years until the next book.
I look forward to a much quicker return. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the novel is At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen, published by Spiegel and Graw. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.